Thank you everyone for standing by. Just need to inform all participants that today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect your line at this time, and you may begin.
Great. Thank you very much. And this is Robin Gross. I'm the chair of the non-commercial stakeholder group. And today we've got a candidacy call with Jeff Newman for the GNSO council chair position that's coming available soon. So that's a little background. And I just really wanted to give Jeff an opportunity to speak to our members and let us know what his concerns are and what his priorities are for the GNSO Council. Should he be elected, what would be his priorities and issues and that sort of thing. So Jeff, why don't you sort of, you know, go into your spiel if you could.
Sure, and you know, feel free to ask any questions, and you know, I commit to being completely open and honest, and no question is out of bounds, so I think a bunch of people that aren't on the call will kind of regret not being able to ask me anything. Such a rare opportunity. But thank you for thank you for hearing me out, I guess. So, you know, I just first want to say that the registries, you know, have not completely decided definitively what we're going to do as far as, you know, I shouldn't say registries, the contracted party's house hasn't definitively decided what we're going to do as far as a candidate, but I'm told by the registries, and that's kind of why Keith is on here as well, by the registries and the registrars, that should I decide to run, I would be the contracted party, contracted house party's candidate. So just wanted to kind of get that out there, and I know there's been some discussions back and forth and some different things that have conversations in the background, but you know, it's primarily one of the reasons I wanted to get on this call was there's been a lot of discussions that have taken place, and I figured I should actually be part of some of those discussions so I can answer any questions. You know, but my primary interest is to run only if we believe, and this is what I told the registries as well, is to run only if I believe that I'm going to get elected. You know, I've been the I've been the vice chair for the contracted party's house for the last couple of years, and you know, I've done a lot of work behind the scenes in support of our chair, Stefan, but also done a lot of work with the ICANN staff, policy staff, and have developed a really great relationship with them. There's a lot that actually happens behind the scenes, and some may call that administrative, but I call it really the important kind of machinery behind the council that makes it run so efficiently. And you know, I'm not sure that the other candidates that I've heard mention really, you know, understand all that work that needs to take place. And it's not all kind of the glory of being a chair, but a lot of kind of developing agendas and having conversations with ICANN staff and making sure work gets done and making sure nothing gets falls through the cracks. And so, you know, I certainly have a deep appreciation for all of the work that goes on there, and I believe that that's just as vital to ensuring an efficient council as, you know, kind of the outward appearance and the speaking engagements and, you know, other things that the chair is invited to. You know, the chair, it's a very important role, and not just in what we think about for, you know, leading the council's meetings, but, like as I said, organizing the council and the work in an efficient manner, and making sure that the council is seen as a productive one and one that is really the model for all of ICANN's bottom-up decision-making. The council needs to, you know, kind of serve in that surrogate role of not making policy itself, but ensuring that the bottom-up process is being followed and ensuring that it's really the constituencies and the stakeholder group and the working groups are really being operated efficiently to make sure that effective policy making can be done. And this is a real critical time for the council. I'm not really referring to the influx of new GTLD applicants that we're going to see participating in the model. We're already seeing that. But also in terms of, you know, there's been a lot of unfair criticism from the outside community, especially the government, and a lot of movement afoot in trying to circumvent the role of the council and really circumvent the whole policy development process as a whole. You know, if there's one thing that people would say about me well, I'm sure there's a lot of things that people say about me, but, you know, one of the good things, anyway, would be that I am a stickler for the policy development process and respecting that process and making sure that it's followed. I truly believe that, you know, this is a very unique model and that we shouldn't have a council or, for that matter, a board that operates in a top-down manner or one that basically wants to force policy upon its groups. And certainly as a registry, we are dependent on the policy development process because, as you know, anything that comes out as a consensus policy affects the way that we operate, in addition to affects, you know, registrants and users. And so all of that needs to you know, be kept in mind when we're doing it. And we're seeing a lot of circumvention. I mean, if you look at things like the Who Is Review Team and others, there's a lot of recommendations in those reports which basically have what we would all consider and we would agree, and I've seen your position on the non-commercial position and the registry's position, which we agree that certain of those recommendations must go through the policy development process. And I think that's important. I think we really need to make sure that as a council and as a chair that we, you know, notice and we take notice of any attempt to circumvent the model, and the Who Is Review Team is one of those where, you know, there's a bunch of people that would like nothing more than to just implement all of the review team decisions or recommendations without kind of respecting the model. That includes things like proxy services and accreditation. I know as a registry, this is something that we believe, and as a user, essentially, we believe all of this needs to go through the policy development process, and there are those in the ICANN world that don't have those kind of views. And so that's something as a chair, they really have to take notice of and stay involved. And so just spend a couple minutes, and please interrupt this if you have any questions, but I wanted to kind of spend a couple minutes on my view as what is a chair and what is the chair's role, because I know that I am certainly an advocate on behalf of the registries, and I know that's concerned some of, you know, am I going to be able to do a serve in a neutral role as the chair of the GNSO Council. And I believe, you know, I have the experience that shows that I can absolutely be neutral. You know, I've led a number of task forces and working groups over the years. Probably the one that took the longest and the one that was kind of, I think, is the role model is the policy development working group with the GNSO improvements. And I know if Avery were on, she and I have discussed that on a number of occasions. And she'd be the first to tell you that, you know, there was a lot of skepticism around the fact that I was chair initially, but I think with all of the groups, they saw that I definitely did not bring in my registry biases into that chair position. And I think that's important. I think neutrality is key. That said, and I know that you may have some questions, Robin, and you and I have had some discussions, that I also believe it's the role of a chair that once a group has made a decision, whatever that decision is, whether I agree with it or not, or the chair agrees with it or not, it's the role of the chair to advocate on behalf of that group. So whether it was the PDP working group where the group came out with a bunch of recommendations, I saw it as my role as a chair to defend those and to advocate on behalf of it, to push that through the process. So oftentimes we all can get lag down in process and things just don't get done. I believe it's the chair's role to move it through the process, even if we as the chair or the person as the chair disagree with the outcome. And so I know that, for example, on the Olympic Committee and Red Cross, I know that the non-commercial group did not agree with the recommendations at the top level. And I know I was criticized by the group for trying to push that through. And you know, the interesting thing, and I think you and I, Robin, may have discussed this, nobody really knows how I personally feel about the recommendations of the IOC or the Red Cross or the GAC recommendations on a personal level. Certainly the registry views are known and were made known, but the reality is that I think it would surprise certain people if they knew how I personally felt on these issues. But that wasn't my role as the chair. My role as the chair was to try to get a decision, and once the decision is done, is to move with it. And that's, frankly, the role of, and that's being neutral. And I think that's the role, that the way I see the role of a GNSO council chair as well. If the council gets behind something, then that's something the chair must defend and advocate on behalf of and push through. That's their advocacy role, whether they personally agree with it or not. So I just wanted, you know, kind of the opportunity to explain that. And, you know, one last
can
item.
Can I just ask, there's been a lot of talk, you know, this last year about how much how much contact there needs to be with the chair and the other members of council when the chair represents the council or wants to send a letter, or even if it's, you know, just a quick note. It seems like oftentimes, just speaking personally, when I look at the GNSO council list, it seems like an awful lot of time and energy is spent sort of, you know, wordsmithing what should really be just a very simple communication. But it just, so I'm wondering how much oversight would you see is necessary or from the council over the chair, and is when the chair's representing the council?
I think that's actually a really good question, and it's sort of issue dependent. I think with certain things like the letter on the Who Is Review Team, I think that was such a fundamental policy issue to the stakeholder groups and constituencies that a letter like that really needs to be carefully tailored to make sure that that represents all of the diverse viewpoints, because oftentimes the board may just, unfortunately, you know, the board's only got so much time, and if they review a letter like on the Who Is Review Team recommendations, they may view that letter as being kind of the view of the, not just the council, but all of its constituency groups. So I think letters like that are pretty important to make sure you have counselors weigh in on, because every word in that letter matters. In other letters, such as, you know, letters like the support of the IRD, so the international registration, or I think those things moved a little too slow. I think those types where the council's already expressed a policy position, you shouldn't necessarily have to have everyone wordsmith it. I think in that kind of instance, one thing I would have liked to have seen is if the chair felt that they needed some support from the groups, is to basically talk to the vice chairs a little bit more and take their temperature to see if, you know, they believe, you know, kind of come to sort of a consensus decision within the three, if they see that there's some sort of issue there. But it's really kind of issue specific. I think a lot of them, you're absolutely right, we spent way too much time on. But others, you know, the fear is that if you basically say that every single letter should just be able to come up from the chair, you're going to get a letter like what was initially drafted for the Who Is Review Team, which is not something, I think, the non-commercials, the initial draft was not something the non-commercials and the registries would have wanted to have seen gone out.
Yeah, okay, thanks. Can I ask you another question about particularly about the role of the GAC in governments? I know we've seen a lot of pressure and momentum going towards giving governments more power and more authority in both the policy development process and at ICANN generally, structurally. So I'm wondering, how do you see the role of governments? Are they equal to the other stakeholders, or maybe a little bit more equal, or how do you think they fit in this model?
Yeah, I'm not sure. It's a good question, too. I'm not sure I see it as kind of a weighing as someone equal or more equal than others. I think, don't get me wrong, I think their role is extremely important. And, in fact, we need the government standing behind the ICANN model in order to get the internal acceptance. There's a lot of, you said pressure, there's a lot of pressure from other countries on basically abolishing a lot of the ICANN model, and that the government should really be the ones with the primary say, and, you know, everyone else should take kind of a back seat. So I think it's very important that we have a balance. And I do believe that when the government speak, we really need to listen. It doesn't mean we need to do what they ask, but it means that we should respect them enough to address their proposals, address their remarks, and respond to it. They have a unique role in that they provide advice directly to the board. So in theory, they never have to come to the GNSO if they don't want to. And if they ever find that it is pointless for them to come to the GNSO to engage in dialogue, they'll just use what the bylaws give them, which is the power to go directly to the board on everything. So, I thought it was critical, and the reason I volunteered for the chair position of the IOC Red Cross is that I thought it was critical to avoid the government circumventing us in the future to directly take on that issue. Whether we wanted to or were prepared to take on that issue at that time, I think of a lot of us in October last year when we first started talking about it, we're kind of sick of the whole rights protections. We thought it was all put to bed, and I felt, I don't know if this surprises you, but personally on a level, I was just as annoyed as you all were that the board in June decided to pass a resolution giving special protections for the Olympic Committee and Red Cross in these backroom meetings with no memo shown to anyone as to what justified their position, and other than the GAC sending these protections. So one of the reasons I fought really heavily to form this drafting team was to get us involved again, because I saw the writing on the wall with both the registrar accreditation agreements at the same time, and also other things, all these other meetings that were held on new GTLB issues that didn't involve the GNSO. And so I know a number of people from your stakeholder group were kind of annoyed that I was kind of picking up the mantle and running with this issue, but it was really primarily something that I really don't, again, this is recorded, so I guess whatever, but personally, I don't care one way or another whether the Olympic marks are protected or the Red Cross marks are protected or not. What I cared about most was being involved in the discussion. And so, yeah, I fought really hard to make sure that the GNSO was in the discussion, much to the chagrin of some of the groups that didn't want to address it at all. But I really felt, and I still feel this way, that if we don't respond to the GAC proposal, it's just going to go around us, and that would be the biggest travesty, much bigger than the GNSO agreeing to something that that we may, on a personal level, may not like.
Okay, thank you. If I can just ask one more question, and it's actually not for me, but from Kathy Kleiman, who was not able to join the call, but she sent me an email, the question to pass along.
Sure.
Non-commercial users and NCUC's views on intellectual property issues. I mean, you've been here, forever, and so you're very deep in the knowledge of what our concerns are, I think, and what our issues are. Should you become chair, how could you help non-commercial users specifically on intellectual property rights issues and the struggles that we have in this community?
Well, again, so let me start with the standard answer I'm supposed to give, and then I'll talk about
what you really think.
No, I mean, look, the chair is not supposed to help one group over the other. Right, it's not supposed to push any kind of ideas over, but the chair's role is to make sure that every voice is heard and that all viewpoints are addressed and make sure that everything is, all the views are respected and addressed, and to make sure to push things forward. That said, taking off kind of more on a personal level, I very strongly believe in the rights of non-IP holders just as much as I believe in the rights of IP holders. So I was on the IRT, which I know is a group that most people kind of, obviously non-commercial didn't support that group. But, I was the voice of the registries, but in a lot of contexts, and you could talk to Mary Wong as well, I helped with those arguments of to make sure that the IP owners didn't get everything that they asked for. And I know it seems like the IRT document was heavily IP-based or biased, and in fact it was, but you have to think of the makeup of that group, which was 18 people, 15 of those were IP attorneys, and then there was Mary, myself, and John Nevitt. And, I was on there primarily, and I was told from the beginning I was there primarily to make sure that whatever they came up with would be implementable by the registries. Because after all, how good is it to come up with protections if you can't actually implement them? But I think Kathy will also let you know that, I was a big proponent of a lot of the non-commercial views on the STI group, and I helped Kathy a great deal to make sure that what she had come up with was also implementable by the registries. And, you know, it was people like me, if you would ever get some feedback on the background of the IRT, you know, I'm the one who basically advocated, and I'm the reason that people are complaining right now, the IP people, that default judgments don't just result in, for the URS, the complainant getting the name or getting the name taken away. It was my arguments that basically won the day with the fact that even in a default judgment, there has to be some substantive review on the merits to make sure that the process is not being abused by the trademark owners that file these URS cases. You know, I'm also the one up there right now advocating on behalf of the RFI, which was just released, for providers, because I did not believe that the decision of fees to trademark owners or fees for the URS should be a decision that's made by WIPO in a national arbitration forum. I believe that there should be competition for that, as opposed to just too much power concentrated between those. So there's a lot of, on a personal level, putting aside the chair role, that, you know, I do believe I'm kind of uniquely positioned to understand the IP rights, but also be on the other side as a registry. We were, even before the non-commercials were seen by a lot of the IP owners as, quote, the dark side, we, the registries, were considered the dark side at first. So I'm certainly very familiar with all those positions. And what's key as the chair is to make sure that those groups that have differing opinions from IP owners, or for that matter, it could be the reverse situation. So those that have differing opinions from the non-commercials in certain issues, that everyone has heard, that the working group outputs reflect the position, accurate positions of everyone there, and that ultimately the council reflects that in a way to the board with any substantive policy. You know, one of the other points while you're thinking of maybe another question is, I really want to emphasize that there's another issue that hasn't really been discussed, and I'm not sure it's been discussed by some of the other candidates, but there's really been a push, too, by certain groups to have the council kind of preside over everything. And one of the things as chair that I want to make sure is that stakeholder groups and constituencies have their autonomy and, we'll say, sovereignty respected as well. I think there's a lot of decisions that need to be made from a stakeholder group as opposed to a council. I know that, for example, I know you've had discussions with Thomas and others, and I just know that there's a bunch of issues that some of the nominating committee members, because they're not in a particular group, they tend to bring all of those to the council and want the council to address. Whereas I think certain issues like who's in your stakeholder group and how your stakeholder group is structured, I strongly and firmly believe that is a stakeholder group issue that should not be taken up by the council.
Thank you.
So I think that's a really important issue, and I thought that, you know, you guys highlighted that issue early on when you formed, when you were talking about the formation of a non-commercial stakeholder group and the whole NTOC, when they were forming. You know, you had asked for the autonomy to determine that, you know, yourselves and to work within your own group, and I think you did. And I think that's the way that type of thing needs to be handled. I think certain people may not share that view and may want that more in the council's purview.
Great. Okay. Thank you very, very much. Did anyone else have any questions? Okay, I don't hear any. Jeff, did you have any other points that you wanted to raise?
Well, so one of the things we're trying to determine, I know there's been discussions, and so maybe if you could help me understand some of the discussions that you've had or your group's had as far as whether you would support one candidate over another. Again, I'm trying to provide this feedback to the registries in fairly quickly because the deadline's coming up, and I don't know if you guys were going to support one candidate or even nominate a candidate. I don't know if you're at liberty to say any of that.
Well, I don't think we've made any decisions, but what I can say is we've scheduled calls with all three candidates, and so we were planning to take this week to talk to each one and then kind of base our decision on that.
Okay, so you say three candidates. You're talking about...
I'm sorry.
Sorry,
Maria, did you...
I, Sorry, I just have to drop off the call. I just wanted to thank Jeff for coming on and sharing his views, and I know lots of the constituency will be listening to the recording.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Thanks, Maria. I'm sorry, Jeff. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, that's okay. But when you said the three candidates, you're talking about Thomas
and Jonathan?
And Jonathan,
yes.
Okay, so he's asked for a meeting with you guys?
I don't actually know which way the asking went. All I know is we've set up calls with all three.
Okay, and are they going to be in the next, like today, or are they going to be, it's just for this week?
Jonathan is tomorrow, and Thomas is Monday.
Okay, so nominations are due tomorrow, I think.
That's correct, tomorrow.
So do you guys have any plans for nominating a candidate tomorrow just to have them on the slate, or?
I think so, because we've set up these interviews that, you know, we want just to have the candidates there for consideration, and then we can decide who to actually vote for.
Okay, so no decisions have been made yet by the non-commercial stakeholder group?
Yep. Yeah, you're our first, you're the first candidate call, so we're just going to have to, you know, see how it goes this week with that.
So what are your other concerns? I mean, I know there's got to be some. I mean, you know, exactly the I know there's got to be some comments. So, I mean, I really want to hear your concerns and try to address them. I think it's kind of important to get it all out there.
Well, I really appreciate that. And you know, frankly, I think you have. You've talked about a lot of the issues that at least, you know, me personally, I care about the circumvention of the policy development process and where to put the GAC. I'm not sure we're, you know, always on the same page, but I think we're, you know, I think you speak to these issues and you do understand at least where I'm coming from, where non-commercial users are coming from on this stuff. I think in terms of what are the other big issues, I think the RAA negotiations and the role of law enforcement. The sort of auto deference to in the ICANN community to giving law enforcement the things they want. And I'm not saying there aren't people who try to stop that, but it's really hard. And there does seem to be this sort of auto deference to, oh, law enforcement says they need this, we got to give it to them, we got to help them. And that is, I think that's a concern of many of our constituents, that there needs to be a little bit more of a balance from that perspective and consider privacy considerations that law enforcement isn't always taking into account. Because their mission is to get the bad guy, and so because that's their mission, they don't always think about protecting other people's privacy rights. And so I think that this sort of auto-deference to law enforcement in RAA negotiations and elsewhere is a concern to our constituents.
Yeah.
So I don't know if you've got any ideas for how we can address that or if we ought to or, you know.
Well, I think... Yeah, I do think we should address it. I think, you know, registrars have been trying to make a valiant effort. I think they've been, a lot of pressure has been put on registrars to agree to a number of things. I think certain things make some sense that law enforcement is asking for, that registrars engage in, you know, trying to verify certain information when it comes in. Much like if you buy a book on Amazon, they're going to verify that your credit card is legit, and that, you know, so I think there are certain things that make a lot of sense from the law enforcement perspective, and actually from a registry perspective, you know, we're one of the more active registries in pursuing fraud and botnets and malware and all that kind of stuff, and so I certainly understand where law enforcement's coming from. But that said, I do have strong opinions on things like the accreditation of proxy services and proxy privacy regulation. I do believe, you know, I'm not too happy with the way that that's progressing right now with ICANN laying out the framework and the registrars alone laying out the framework. I believe that is a policy issue. I believe that that's something that you know, the registrars can agree with ICANN to work on that program. But a lot of that is policy issues that really need to come back to the GNSO community. And so I know Keith is on the phone, and Keith knows my position on this and within the registries, and I've certainly been a strong advocate for making sure that things like that go through the policy development process as opposed to being developed by ICANN staff and registrars alone. So I do think that there needs to be a better balance. That said, I do think that we like the GAC. We need to listen to law enforcement. We need to let them have a voice. And we need to try to, in certain circumstances, we need to try to see if a compromise or something can be done to, what's the word I'm looking for? Something can be done to kind of ease their concerns, but in a way that, like you said, that does not trample on privacy rights or does not trample on, you know, the users, essentially. And I do think those compromises can be made or can be met. And I do think that we can come to them if we all come to these discussions with an open mind, and as long as they're implementable by the contracted parties and don't end up passing on huge amounts of cost to the registrants.
Right. Okay. Well, I think that was really the only issues I had. I'm sorry, I don't want to interrupt. Is somebody else?
Yeah, this is I joined late. I apologize. I got here late. So I didn't hear the first part of the conversation. But there is a question I'd ask, and if it's already been asked and answered, tell me so, and I'll go listen to the recording. And one of the things that I'm looking at in terms of the neutral chair is how do you handle situations where it's obvious at times that one or the other constituencies or stakeholder groups basically uses every agreement as something to step on and to build on the next agreement. So every time you think you've reached a compromise with someone that's got a pointed set of purposes to defend something at all costs, you reach a consensus for them. You think everybody's agreed good purpose, and then all of a sudden you turn around and they started their next battle with the previous compromise as the base position. So how do you, as a neutral chair, deal with that kind of behavior?
Yeah, thanks, Aubrey. And no, I have not answered that question yet, so thank you for raising it. I think setting precedent is really what you're talking about. And I think that is, and Keith can actually attest to this, because that's something that within the registry stakeholder group I am keenly aware of, and something that, I'm always very careful about if we're going to engage in a compromise to make it clear that this is a compromise based on these facts and circumstances. And I think that was something that, as the chair, it's incumbent on that kind of I can go on my experience as a working group chair. It's incumbent that that's reflected in the document. So, for example, in the IOC situation, it was very clear that we were making this recommendation. The group made the recommendation as a one-time only recommendation. It was not to replace the PDP, and it was this is only for now and should not be held as setting precedent for future matters. I think that that's key to remember and point out to, as a chair, is to make sure that groups don't do what you said and build on that precedent. You know, since we allowed it once, it's got to be allowed every other time. And I've certainly been saying that in fact, Avi, if you look at the PDP, when I, as the chair, made these presentations to the council on the PDP recommendations, I was very clear that it wasn't, that if the council were to unravel any one of these recommendations or should say no to any one of these recommendations, that too would have an impact on every other recommendation, and that the council shouldn't be picking and choosing which recommendations it wanted, that if it had any issues, it should send it back to the group. I think that's sort of a kind of an analogous situation where it's incumbent on the working groups that send products to the council to make it clear what the assumptions are based off of and to point that out when the next item that may try to build on that. So you know, in this IGO example or this Red Cross IOC, if there is a recommendation that comes out of the group for the moratorium, it's going to be very, and I'm not presupposing the outcome, but if that's what comes out, then it's going to be very important as me as the chair to point out to the council and to the GAC that this is a recommendation only for as long as the PDP is going on and only if the PDP is going on. So if you, the council, decide not to initiate the PDP on the IGO and Red Cross, then all bets are off on our recommendation. So I think being aware of those assumptions and making sure and being reminded if ever I as the chair or whoever is the chair forgets about it, it's going to be important. I hope that answers your question, Alvia.
No, actually, an interesting answer on a different topic. And I guess I probably wasn't clear in the question. To get to the various occasions over the years,
you're breaking up.
I'm sorry. To a particular decision on, for example, IP rights and who is issues. And we get to the point, and we think we've had a sewn-up deal, and this has been happening since I've been involved with the GNSO, where you think you've had an agreement with IP on something, and then all of a sudden that something becomes for their next assault in defense of their single purpose. And one or another constituency will actually, I'm not talking where, like in IOC, we're going to have a mixed case, we're going to have, you know, disagreement statements, et cetera. But you actually get to a point where you think you've got a deal, and then all of a sudden, within weeks, you find that the people that made the deal with you went to the board, said this deal is totally unsatisfactory, but that ends up being the base. And so you find yourself in a situation where you've got a council where there's at least one set of parties you can never deal with because you know that they will always walk away from their deal but use it as a starting point for the next fight. And so I wonder, how as a chair do you deal with that element inside the council? Like what work this time?
Yeah, a lot of that kind of cut off, but I think I understand the question, and it's not an easy one to answer. I think it's up to the chair, and this is kind of my answer. It's up to the chair to advocate on behalf of what the council actually did, as opposed to what groups going beyond it. And I think the new GTLD process was kind of indicative of that, right? And I think that's kind of what you're pointing to is where, you know, you did this PDP on the new GTLDs, or I don't know if it was a PDP or a policy process. No, it was a PDP, sorry. And all of a sudden you come to these compromises, and then a group goes around it and lobbies the board to basically say that they're not satisfied with it, and then that which you've reached these compromises now becomes the base. Is that your question, I think?
Yeah, that's pretty much it.
Okay. So obviously, some of that's within control of the chair, and some of that's not necessarily within control of the chair. So obviously, the part of sticking by the GNSO and sticking to the PDP and advocating on behalf of it, of the results reached by the council, is within the control of the chair, and to make those arguments to make sure that the board understands that this was a compromise reached with in discussing all these issues, and there's really nothing new that was brought up. The problem that's outside the control of the chair is the fact that, in that case, the board then has its own mandate where it says, okay, thank you, Gina, so we've heard you. We've also heard the governments and the IPC. Now I want you to go back and do some more, essentially. And unfortunately, the chair doesn't have much control over to say, no, we won't do any more on this. The chair can make its arguments and can try to, in its policy process, discuss with the groups, the stakeholder groups, the constituencies, the approach for addressing that issue, but it's not really a chair issue in and of itself. It's more, you know, how does the community want to address it? And I think with new TLDs, you had an interesting group of people that came up out of the woodwork in between the time that the GNSO passed its resolution or approved the PDP and sent it to the board to when the time that the board approved the PDP and then started its discussions on implementation. I think that was really kind of a unique item. I'm hoping that doesn't repeat history, but in between that time, you had new TLD applicants that kind of emerged, and you have a lot of voices, strong voices within the community basically saying that, hey, we're going to be a new TLD applicant, and if we can compromise on certain things, maybe we can make this process move faster. So there were a lot of kind of externalities, I'll say, and there still are, by the way. This is not unique for back then. This is still the case. Now that ICANN has got a lot of money from the applicants, there's a lot of applicants coming out of the woodwork putting a lot of pressure on trying to find quick compromises in order to have the program move forward. So some of it's within the council control, some of it's not. The chair is an advocate for the council and making sure its rights and positions are respected, but in the end, if the board issues a mandate that's legitimate under the board jurisdiction to do, then it's also the chair's responsibility to make sure it's addressed. I hope that helps. Well, if Aubrey's still on. Am I still on?
Yes, you're still on. Maybe she dropped off for a second.
It was a real tough question. It's not one that, that was a tough one. Good question, Aubrey, if you're listening.
It is a challenge that we face, for sure. Did anyone else have any questions, or was there anything else you wanted to discuss?
You know, I think that's it, and no matter who you guys, you know, I would love the opportunity, if there's other questions, while you're determining what candidate to support, I would love the opportunity to talk with you in case additional questions come up, or, you know, like I said, there's been a lot of discussions in the background on this, some of which are true, some of which are not so true, and I'm a person that is always open, and I would rather have things aired out in the open, even if it's not positive for me. I would just ask that if there's any questions or people say things like, I hear Jeff is saying this or that, or I hear whatever it is, you know, I would love the opportunity to address those directly as opposed to just relying on kind of backroom discussions.
Well, I really appreciate that. Thank you. And I also really appreciate your willingness to talk with us today. And I think most people will be listening to this and may, in fact, have some questions, you know, now that the issues have been raised and they've had a chance to hear from you. I expect I will get some questions from the members, and so I will forward them over to you. You know, we can figure out a way to handle that when that happens, but I expect there will be some more questions.
Okay, and just make sure that, you know, so a lot of this is about kind of the council chairs, positions, and things. I also think it's incredibly important not to underestimate the amount of work that the chair and even the vice chair do. Talk to Mary, talk to Wolf, talk to Stefan even about, you know, there's a lot that happens behind the scenes and, you know, a lot that happens with ICANN policy staff and making sure this happens. And, you know, I would say 75% of the work is really behind the scenes. And 25%, if that, is at the meetings and the public meetings and any time the GNSO council chair needs to be out there in any kind of representative capacity. And I would just hate to see that lost in the shuffle of, you know, what has to be done because that really is critical for the council to operate in an efficient and effective manner.
Well, I can tell you, as somebody who's been the chair of the NCSG for the last year, that is so true. There is about one, you know, for every 1 hour of meeting time, there's about 3 hours of preparation and organization and whatnot that goes into that 1 hour. So I know what you mean. It is an enormous amount of work that is all countless little emails here and there just organizing things. And so it's a big it's a big job not to be taken lightly.
Yes, absolutely. I totally respect the work you're doing, and Keith is the incoming chair for the Registry Stakeholder Group, so he will, and he's been doing a lot as the assistant chair anyway, so he'll be in the thick of it as well.
Great. Well, thank you again for taking the time to talk with us, and I'll be in touch when I hear back from my members with some more questions if they've got them.
Thanks, Robin.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right, bye.